Okay, just before we start, or as we start, I want to once again thank Sandy Welkis and Kenny Wintman, who are sponsoring today's shiur in Yard Site, Observing the Yard Site, for their mother. They sponsored for their father on Thursday. Their parents passed away 4 days apart. Today is the 24th Yard Site of their mother, Sarah Bluma, but Kalman Mordechai HaKohen. So we want to wish the family good memories, long life, and the Neshama should have an Aliyah, and we should come together for happy occasions. So thank you very much. Okay, Naomi, now we can get started. I think the official title is the Beis Yaakov post-Holocaust, the recreation of Beis Yaakov, I guess, on these shores. Vakasha, thank you.
So what? Not actually on these shores. I'm talking about the DP camps today. Since I can't remember, is it okay to dedicate a talk that's already been dedicated?
You can mention, we didn't talk about it. You also want to add in
I want to add in another dedication to my mother, who's turning 100 in about 10 days.
Wow. That's worthy of many dedications. That's worthy of many dedications. Baruch Hashem. Wow, very nice.
So I'm just going to share my screen and go through some basic material about some history about Beis Yaakov during and immediately after the Holocaust. And then I have a text that I thought we could read closely, which is a letter from Bergen-Belsen by a Beis Yaakov teacher named Rivka Horowitz. But let me go through my slideshow first and I'll give you some history. I can't figure out what that photo, I think that's Max Weinreich. I don't know what he's doing in my PowerPoint, but I love that photo so much. Let's move on to the next one. So this is a map of some of the DP camps. So there were something like 250,000 people in DP camps around the world after the war, of which I was trying to find firm data. It's very hard to find firm data, but let's say somewhere less than 10% of that group was religious. And of course, it's very hard to say what it meant to be religious after the war. It was certainly less than in 1939. So, the percentage of people who were, let's say, Shomer Shabbos and kosher before the war was certainly higher than that. There was a drop off, let's say. And even among this 8% of people who somehow retained their orthodoxy, it was still very questionable whether people would remain orthodox. It wasn't the infrastructure to be orthodox. People lost their faith. People were ripped out of family environments that had kept them orthodox. So we have here like a very, I'm sorry, when I said orthodox, what I should have said is affiliated with the Aguda in some way. So 8%. There were other people who were Orthodox who were not affiliated with the Aguda. Something like that is, I read that statistic for whatever it's worth. I don't know what it means. The largest of these DP camps was Fehrenwald. So what are we talking about with the DP camp? Fehrenwald was a former army base that had been a kind of royal town before that. These are generally pretty nice places to be living. So don't think about a refugee camp now for, I don't know, Syrian refugees in Turkey. These are places in which there were dormitories, there were jobs. They were run by the Americans, the British, the Soviets, etc. You see here the occupied, they were run by the different occupying forces. In Fehrenwald, where my parents met, I've seen maps. I should have brought a map. The streets were all named for American cities and states. So you could live on Vermont Street or Mississippi Street. And this will become relevant in a minute. If you were a married couple, you were guaranteed your own room. Otherwise, people lived in big dormitories. And this was a kind of impetus for marriage, very important in how the Orthodox community reconstructed itself. I just want to give you a sense of what you have are basically an Orthodox community that's just been decimated, and in which even people who had been affiliated with the community beforehand, many of them were no longer Orthodox, and there was a kind of hardcore of people trying to reverse this situation and trying to rebuild Orthodox life. And to cut to the chase, this was the beginning of, this looked like a kind of lost cause, and it turned out not to be. It turned out that many, that the Orthodox world, and surprisingly to many observers, rebuilt itself tremendously after the war. So what we're talking about here in this particular, oh, let me change my slideshow, is just a kind of, how did this happen? How did the Orthodox community, which was devastated, physically, spiritually wrecked, totally out, I don't know if outgunned is the right word, but there were many, you know, the Zionists and many other groups had the Joint Distribution Committee. They had much fewer resources in whatever, in Palestine, the land of Israel. You have, in the land of Israel and in North America, you have basically small marginal Orthodox communities. So these were not the big communities in the Orthodox world. Those were back in the European heartland. And it was the Orthodox Jews in the land of Israel and the Orthodox Jews in the United States who had to, and Canada, who somehow had to help the devastated survivors of the Holocaust rebuild and attract them to either Palestine or to North America to help rebuild Orthodox life there where it was impoverished and needed reinforcement. So that's the basic cultural context in which I want to talk about the role of Beis Yaakov in this period. I think I was going to say Fehrenwald, I think, had around 40,000 people in it as the largest one. There's actually, this map isn't quite big enough to, these are the major camps for Jewish displaced persons. There were also, there was a camp on an island just off of Stockholm. There was a camp in Cyprus. There was a camp in Rhodes. There was a camp in Shanghai. Camps in many other places, Italy, besides this. And this was the kind of the scene of post-war life. So let's just talk about marriage. So the bulk of the people in these DP camps were between the ages of 15 to 29. So this is a very, a largely young, I really should have put some photos of Orthodox marriages because there are plenty of that. But this is a very young population, sort of for obvious reasons. These are the people who somehow managed to survive. They were almost all orphaned. And in the Orthodox world, and basically there's a marriage rush in these DP camps among all sectors, but particularly within the Orthodox world. So the Orthodox world basically figured out that a couple was more likely to stay Orthodox than singles, particularly when the marriages were contracted in a certain way that I'll try to describe. This was generally true in the DP camps for all sectors. So one of the things, there was a kind of mad rush to marry for all kinds of reasons, including the fact that you could get your own room in otherwise very crowded quarters. In the case of Orthodox Jews, the Klosenberger Rebbe, who was one of the, who was a Rebbe from Transylvania, a Rav from Transylvania, Klosenberger Rav is what he was, sorry, who was one of the major people trying to organize religious life in Fehrenwald, who actually came to the DP camp because he understood this to be a source of you know, people to rebuild Orthodox life. He came from Romania to Ferenwald. He actually brought my mother. My mother was on her way to Palestine, and he said, no, you got to come to Ferenwald. So he brought my mother to Ferenwald to start a Beis Yaakov there. But in the DP camp, the Orthodox community, whatever the rebbes, the rabbis, the rebbes, the few surviving leaders and activists, were trying to persuade young people to marry each other. The Klosenberger Rebbe raised money to give each couple a $50 cash prize if the woman would agree to cover her hair after marriage. So, and these weddings were a major source of social life and religious family, celebratory life, kind of the revival of life in the DP camps. Now, how were marriages contracted in the absence of parents, and especially in the Orthodox world, who were in charge of making marriages happen? So marriages have to be contracted differently. In Salzheim was, for instance, a DP camp that was designated for Orthodox girls, and there were no boys there. But activists would go from one camp to another, to the Salzheim camp and to the other camp, and try to set people up. So, and what were the criteria? The old criteria no longer functioned. So nobody had any money. Nobody had, and yichus seemed like it was no longer a relevant criterion when parents aren't around and people are. So a major criterion was where you came from. So these DP camps basically housed people from all over Eastern Europe and Central Europe, etc. Marriages were often contracted on the basis of similarity in, if you came from the same hometown, that was considered a good enough reason. And I mean, there were also people were starting out their life journey, and to have somebody at your side. I'll also remind people that if they don't know that within the Orthodox community, there were many fictitious marriages that were contracted at the beginning of the war, because the Joint Distribution Committee was sending these, providing visas for yeshiva boys and not for Beis Yaakov girls. Beis Yaakov girls, enterprising as they were finding boys and asking them to marry them. The Russia yeshivas were telling the boys to marry the girls. Boys were often reluctant to do that. They felt that their chances of survival may go down if they were, you know, having to take care of somebody else, take care of a woman. But there were many fictitious marriages that were contracted. Many of these became actual marriages, and the same in the DP camps. And what happened at these weddings? These weddings were, and maybe at this point they'll mention Rivka Horowitz. So Rivka Horowitz was the Aguda representative, women's representative in the Bergen-Belsen DP camp, which was not in the death camp. I forget if it was a death camp or a labor camp, Bergen-Belsen. I think it may have been a labor camp. It was just outside of that camp. She was actually the main Aguda representative there. I have a photo of her in the next slide, I think. The Aguda provided her with a dress, a nice dress. And because she was an important representative and they wanted her to look good at various meetings. And her dress was lent out every night to girls to go on dates, and was also used for weddings. And at these weddings, the weddings would be, the whole camp came out, as much resources that could be provided would go into the provision for these weddings. And the Klosenberger himself and various other people resisted the rhetoric of, we are marrying you off in this crazy rushed fashion in order to rebuild Orthodox life. He always said, we hope you find peace and the rest that you deserve to the young married couple. And he always mentioned their parents. There were Aguda representatives that knew some of these people's parents. The parents would be invoked. And at this wedding, the young couple would be told that their parents were there under the, this is already like an old folk understanding that dead parents are present at weddings. This was a big part of the emotional power of the wedding in DP camps. And with these weddings, with these, let's call them kind of rushed weddings, but also incredibly meaningful, people understood that what they were doing was trying to basically refill the ranks of Orthodox Judaism. And, you know, with these weddings was also a kind of not just joy and rebirth, but also huge pain and loss. These were major points at which the loss was felt as powerfully as the gain. And so basically what you have in these DP camps is a baby boom. And let me show you some more photographs. And a particular baby boom and marriage boom. So, you know, hundreds of weddings, multiple weddings a night kind of thing, that are the major tool that Orthodox activists have to try to keep Orthodox, to try to revive the Orthodox world. The other tool was also for rebuilding life and creating life for Orthodox girls and women, just in its, let's say, female homosocial variety. And what you see here is the Beis Yaakov in Fehrenwald that my mother started. And my mother is, just to point her out, if you look at the sign and you go up to the top right two people, my mother has a white collar. So that's my mother. My mother was brought to Fehrenwald in order to...
Are you sharing?
Someone say something?
Are you sharing a screen?
Yes, it's shared. Do you not see this screen? Does anybody else see it?
I see it fine.
I see it.
So sorry, that's a photo of a photo. I got to get better photos. But there's my mother. As I said, my mother was brought from Romania, away from her plans to move to Palestine. We can also talk about the Zionism of the Orthodox world. It was basically a mass, whatever anti-Zionism there was in the Orthodox world seemed to disappear in the DP camps, not through any kind of ideological, you know, intention, but through a kind of emotional, you know, we have to go to we have to go to the land of Israel after what we've gone to. So there were real rapprochements with Zionists, at least working together in various ways, despite the official anti-Zionism of the Aguda. And the Aguda was overselling what it had accomplished in the land of Israel, but telling people it's now kosher to go to Palestine. We have our environments. So basically, Beis Yaakov, let me just say a little bit about Beis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov was poised to help rebuild life in the DP camps because it already had an organized cadre of trained young people who knew each other from conferences and conventions and summer programs, and were basically indoctrinated to start Beis Yaakov wherever they went with whatever resources they had. My mother, like other Beis Yaakov teachers, started a Beis Yaakov in the ghetto that she was in. This was done either openly or underground in at least five or six other ghettos. I'm sure there are many more. My mother's ghetto is not was an open ghetto. There was no wall around it, but it was where the people from the surrounding towns were sent to. And she started a Beis Yaakov there and had 90 girls in her Beis Yaakov in Turdun, Transylvania, which was in the Romanian, it wasn't in Nazi occupied, it was in Romania. And my mother was sent into the camp to start a Beis Yaakov. In other camps, there were Holocaust survivors who had gone through the camps, which my mother hadn't, who were there in a DP camp because they were in, you know, displaced people. Not like my mother, who was sent in by the Aguda or by Klausenberger. who started Beis Yaakov very quickly. So among the first sort of grassroots initiatives was to start Beis Yaakov. It was a way to organize the young girls and women, also a way to arrange marriages. And in these DP camps, despite the fact that Beis Yaakov was really for unmarried women, in interwar Poland, as it still is today, in the DP camps, as you'll see, married and unmarried girls and women spend time together. This is one of my favorite photos from the DP camps. This is in the Bad Gastein DP camp. And the reason why I love this photo so much, and as you can see, it's Beis Yaakov L'chuvenelcha B'or Hashem. And then down by the table, there's another sign that says Benos. Benos was more the youth movement for working girls. Beis Yaakov was more the school, either for younger girls or for girls studying to be teachers. My mother set up a seminary so that teachers needed to be trained too. My mother created a textbook out of what had been a SS officer's receipt booklet from memory, which is now in the Orthodox Museum in Brooklyn called Amud Eish. But the reason, one of the reasons why I love this photo so much is that in the front row, directly behind the wine bottle, if that's wine, is a woman named Itka As, who was a famous fighter of the partisans. She was in the woods with the Bielski brothers, along with her sister. That's her sister sitting next to her, and an adopted sister who's in a white shirt underneath the Beis Yaakov sign. And she was known as her nickname was the Tzadekes, because she somehow tried to keep kosher and or Shabbos in the woods. Maybe she managed. It's hard to know whether these reports of people who managed to keep kosher and Shabbos, how true they are. But in any case, even the effort, of course, is laudable. And she was known as the Tzadekes, and she was one of five women in the Bielski brothers camp who were given pistols. So she herself personally killed a few German soldiers. So she, along with being a Beis Yaakov girl, she was a famous partisan. And when she came to Bad Gastein, she was among the first things she did was to help organize this Beis Yaakov and Benos chapter. And this one, unlike the one in Fehrenwald, which was kind of organized from the top, was a grassroots effort, as most of them, in fact, were. But once a DP camp had a running Beis Yaakov, just like in the first days with Sarah Schneerer, they would train somebody to go to the next Beis Yaakov, to go to the next DP camp and try to organize the Orthodox girls there. And what we're talking about is not so much Orthodox girls as girls who might be persuaded to come back to the Orthodox fold through the various means of persuasion that we've already talked about, including just camaraderie and, a feeling of wanting to do something maybe for their dead parents, etc. Where is this one? Kibbutz Benos Agudas Yisrael. I forgot to write down where this one is. So here's another DP camp. This one is, I think I already showed you this picture. This is Beis Yaakov in Shanghai. So Beis Yaakov, and I love this picture. Beis Yaakov in Shanghai was founded actually during the war for refugees, many of them from the Mir Yeshiva, who had these visas provided by the Joint Distribution Committee. And Beis Yaakov girls before and in the beginning of the war married these boys in fictitious marriages or whatever, or they were already married. And this is the community of basically Lithuanian yeshivas and their wives and their daughters and the school they started in Shanghai, which operated until around, I think, 1947. The one in Fehrenwald was the one that lasted the longest. It lasted until 1957. Okay, so who were the women? What do we know about some of the women? Oh, somebody raised their hand. Did somebody want to ask a question?
We can do the questions at the end, unless it's...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So let me just say, so who are some of these women? So among the... among the stories, so basically what you have is a culture of sacred legend, some of which is clearly fictitious, some of which is true. In the DP camps, the stories began to circulate. All kinds of stories began to circulate about Orthodox survival, including the story of the Ani Mamin that was sung at every... Where other secular Jews and Zionists sang Zognit Kainmol, which is a song, a ghetto song from the partisans. In the Orthodox community, what was sung was Ani Mamin. And the tune for that Ani Mamin legendarily was written in a train car on the way to Auschwitz and sung in the gas chamber. And somehow somebody got out of that train car. And this was passed along to the Orthodox community. So you have these stories about spiritual heroism during the Holocaust that start to circulate in the Orthodox world, along with this tune for Ani Mamin, which was sung in the gas chamber and written in a cattle car, and became the kind of theme song of the Orthodox DP community. It's the kind of sad, there are many tunes to Ani Mamin. It's the saddest one that you probably know. And this is an example of one of the sacred legends. We have another sacred legend, if you want to call it that. And this one is actually historically accurate, maybe not in every detail, but in its basic, outline. And it's about 10 Beis Yaakov girls that survived together. They weren't all Beis Yaakov girls. As a matter of fact, one of them was a totally secular girl who just fell in with the group, who was the writer, the Israeli novelist Michal Govrin's mother, and who basically had this photograph of themselves from before the war, that somebody smuggled into the camp in a bar of soap, and that somehow survived the war. And this is the photograph. It's been reproduced in many different ways. And among the women in this group are Pearl Banish, who became very important as the Orthodox historian of Beis Yaakov and biographer of Sarah Schneer. Carry Me in Your Heart. And she traveled, she died at the age of 104, about 5 years ago. She traveled the Orthodox world giving talks about Beis Yaakov. And she was among the group. And she was also the one who wrote To Vanquish the Dragon. She wrote the history of this group. But the woman that I'm focusing on is Rivka Horowitz, who's the woman in the center of the photo. I'll show you the whole photo in a minute, who's the one who basically single-handedly, without any institutional support, at least at the beginning from the Aguda, because the Aguda was stretched thin and didn't make it to Bergen-Belsen immediately. She started a Beis Yaakov in Bergen-Belsen herself on her own. There were actually two Beis Yaakovs in Bergen-Belsen, one for Polish girls and one for Hungarian, Transylvanian, Czechoslovakian girls, young women. And then she started Beis Yaakov's in 12 other DP camps. She's the one who was given a dress that she loaned out. She's estimated to have made hundreds, maybe as many as 1,000 matches. And she herself married a man named Leib Pinkasevich, who was affiliated with Aguda. This was a kind of typical DP camp marriage, which closely resembles my parents' DP camp marriage. My parents met in Ferenwald, as I said. So leading Beis Yaakov teachers marrying leading Aguda activists. In my parents' case, it was a mixed marriage, Hungarian, Polish. So it was different from the usual kind of marriage. It was a kind of Aguda was the link, not the where they came from. But Rivka Horowitz Pinkasevich also made a what could be called an elite Aguda marriage, and ended up moving to Antwerp and reviving the Antwerp Beis Yaakov, which had been founded in 1934. And except for a small period during the Holocaust, during the war, the Antwerp Beis Yaakov, as far as I know, is the longest, continuously, the oldest Beis Yaakov in the world. So, and she and her husband were mainstays of this Beis Yaakov after the war, when they made it to Antwerp. She also helped revive Nishe Agudas Yisrael, the women's organization of the Aguda. So here's the photo as it survived. Pearl Banish is on the top right. You can see this is a photo from before the war. So this is a Beis Yaakov photo that made it through the Holocaust, that survived the Holocaust. I mean, other photos survived in different ways, but this is the one that actually spent a few years in Auschwitz. Sha'arim was the Orthodox press. I think it was Harry Goodman in London who was the publisher. I have to look that up again. And there you see on the front page, Kriyat Morot Beit Yaakov mi Bergen-Belsen. A call from Beis Yaakov teachers in Bergen-Belsen. This was, what's the date? I think 45. So very soon after the end of the war, what you have here is a letter from Rivka Horowitz from Bergen-Belsen, which is her first contact with anyone from the Aguda. So she's in a camp which has basically lost contact with Aguda. So I think what I want to do is just read the letter. Sorry, it's a little long. I'll just read it. It'll take me, I don't know, 6 or 7 minutes. And then I'll stop my share. And I would love to have a conversation with you about what I read and what I said and anything else you want to say. Sorry, I just have to move around the photo so I could see the, here we go. Dear friends, may you be well. I am writing to you from a desolate town in Germany where we ended up by various routes. There is much that should be said about this experience, but I will leave for another opportunity. You do not know me, and I do not know you, but that does not prevent me from turning to you for help. There is no time now for me to tell you everything we went through, and more particularly, what a hell it was for an observant Jew. But I want to stress one fact. The truth of our faith stood out absolutely clearly, particularly in these experiences and tortures. Armed with faith, a faith inscribed in the heart, it was possible to walk the path of the most unbearable suffering and remain pure. Rather than abandoning the ways of modesty, it was particularly there that religious Jews recognized the value and power of modesty. Rather than trampling on decency and love, there they understood how important these are in life and what life is like without them. It was for that reason that religious Jews, even in the camp, based their lives on different principles. Religious people did not lose their moral compass. Tragically, only a few such people managed to survive. The greatest and best went the fiery way of the ovens. A few survivors were dispersed to various refugee camps. Among these survivors are to be found in Bergen-Belsen, a group of members of the Aguda, including some women. A few of the most serious of these women are Beis Yaakov teachers and B'nos members from Sanz, we were just talking about Sanz, Krakow, Sanok, and elsewhere. When we were liberated from the camp and first tasted the taste of freedom, we began to search for the world which we had faith that we would find after everything that happened. We had not expected or believed that the world, the war would end the way it did. Was it for this that the Jewish religiosity of Polish Jewry had been destroyed, its world drowned in an ocean of blood, for things to remain exactly the same as before? Were these not the footsteps of the Messiah? It is difficult, after living the way we did, to face the ordinary world of before. It is at this threshold that we now stand. Unfortunately, no one among the individuals assigned to our care can help this kind of survivor. We were assigned to the supervision of an English rabbi, a secular Zionist. It was because of him that we were transferred to a different place within a month. No one shared with us the purpose of this move, but its effect was to isolate us from the rest of our community. After the British occupiers arrived, we were put in the well-known death camp Bergen-Belsen, from which we were first moved to Bergen and then to Lingen. The rabbi wanted to turn our group into a secular Zionist kibbutz. If we had realized this, we would not have left Bergen, but we were made aware of this only later. You can imagine how hard our lives were there in Gullus among Jews, in exile among Jews. You can imagine our joy when we received greetings from you in Orthodox Jewry from Dr. Klepfisch, the military chaplain of the Polish army. These greetings lightened our loneliness and desolation, for surely among you must be organized groups of young religious Jews in faithful observance of what we had sacrificed the marrow of our being for under such harsh conditions. This knowledge would give us support and allow us to go on. So we decided to write you this letter, for certainly you will understand what we are feeling and be moved by our double isolation in our homelessness and in the lack of an appropriate atmosphere for us, an atmosphere of moral exaltation that seeks something more, for man does not live by bread alone. We need your help. First and foremost, send us newspapers and periodicals and news of our movement. We are living here as if on a desert island in conditions that are not easy. We lack an environment, food, clothing. There's not a single Jewish book here. Please send us a Bible with rabbinic commentaries and a Hebrew dictionary. Also Ethics of the Fathers with commentaries, ethical literature, Jewish history, etc. We think that in the course of time, there will be those who find some value in these sacred books. And so there is an urgent need for them. As of now, there are only a few young yeshiva students here who need them, and we ourselves will learn from them and then go on to teach. But as you know, we are helpless to do anything here, and we look to you for anything you can do for us. We do not participate in the life here, in our desire to carve out our own corner, more beautiful and substantial, and we long for the moment when we can begin our work anew. Do you know anything about our friends in other camps? And if you do, please send them our regards. This will give us great joy. We will not be left with a connection only to you and with the longing and anticipation of a better and finer life. We hope for your immediate assistance in any form whatsoever, for everything has been withheld from us. We do not ask for your pity, but rather call on you to fulfill the debt of friendship. Where are the religious survivors of German Jewry? Do you have Rabbi Jacob Rosenheim's address, the head of the Aguda? And what are our chances of receiving certificates? Do we have any reason to hope in this regard for the help of our activists and people? With blessings, Rivka Horowitz. I'm going to stop my share. Hi, everybody. Okay, so that's my presentation. I just remembered that I wanted to say one other thing, which is that I talked about the sort of the different attitudes of different rabbis, some of whom, where was Rivka Horowitz from? She was Polish. She had studied in the Krakow Teacher Seminary with Sarah Schnierer. I forget the name of her small town. She had been a Beis Yaakov teacher before the war. I think it's, she mentions where she was a teacher in that list of towns that she mentions. Maybe I'll just say one other thing, which is that this is a period in which rabbis, there are all kinds of halachic issues about if, you know, women could go back to their husbands, women who had lost their husband, whose husbands had disappeared and it wasn't known where they were. The rabbis, I already told you about the rabbi who didn't talk about you will rebuild the Orthodox world, but said, your parents are here with you. We hope you will bring peace. In the same way, this rhetoric of we managed to keep our religious values intact. This is the beginning of a kind of discourse that's not 100% formulated yet. And it's one in which we have collections of responsa from the DP camps where the rabbis are saying, you know, your wife has a tattoo that says Nazi prostitute. Yes, you may go back to her. And no, she should not remove that tattoo. That tattoo is a mark of honor and she should feel nothing but pride. So there's some amazing attempts of the Orthodox community to look forgivingly at this question of what it is, how people had survived, and the question of whether it was the best who had survived or the worst. The theology of who had survived was alive and well in this period of, you know, if you had survived, the suspicion was you had done something bad. So it's a real complicated discourse being worked out here, not from above, but mostly from the grassroots by these writers who are in the months immediately after the war, basically pouring out their hearts in various ways. So this is why, one of the reasons why this is such a precious document is this is a document by a woman before this discourse has been solidified, before the Orthodox world has figured out what to say about the Holocaust, before the real process of rebuilding has begun. So I see some hands. Should we start with Rochelle and then on to Shelley?
Ken, there are still a couple questions in the chat box you didn't quite get to. Maybe you want to take those first and then we'll go to the oral question.
So should I go to the chat? Would you mind fielding those and just telling them?
I'm going to field this. Yes. Okay. Not all people in D camp were Jewish. Okay. I think that's fine. I think that's more a statement. The total number of non-Jewish DPs well exceeded that. Okay. Unless you want to comment. Somebody says the Klosenberger.
Wait, the total number of non-Jewish Jews in the DP camps exceeded the Jewish?
That's what somebody is claiming. I don't know. Maybe if, you know, I don't have the numbers, but
I didn't know that either. So as I said, it's very hard to find statistics or whatever. Whatever I said, do your own research.
Okay. Somebody's claiming that Klosenberger was indeed the Rebbe. The Rev was the official chief rabbi of Klosenberg, and that was Rabbi Glasner. I wonder, is that the Glasners of the descendants of the Chatham Sofer, I presume you mean by that Glasner.
So the Rav of Klosenberg was.
He's claiming the Rav of Klosenberg was the Glasner. I mean, he doesn't say.
The Glasner family, that's the Klosenberger Rebbe, not the Klosenberger Rav.
Right.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Klosenberger's Glasner is there. Fine. That's from the family of the Chatham Sofer, the Glasners. What is a fictitious marriage? You want to answer that?
So a fictitious marriage is a marriage done for, what I mean by fictitious marriage is, for instance, I'll give you an example. The Devora Eppelgrad, who meets Yeshiva Bacher at a wedding in Vilna in 1940. She's at the wedding to sell the Beis Yaakov journal, but she's also looking for a yeshiva boy who can save her life with one of these, I think it's 1940, who can save her life, who has one of these visas, and she knows that there's yeshiva bachurim. And she actually makes a proposition to this boy, and she says, put me on your visa. We can have a civil marriage. I will not expect anything more from you. We'll sleep in separate bedrooms. We are not actually officially married according to Jewish law. And she gets put on his visa. He knows the Rosh Hashiva wants him to be finding a girl whose life to save. And he makes his way with Devora to Kobe. And they're still not married according to Jewish law. And somewhere on this trip, they get married. I don't know if you could say they fall in love or whatever. But it becomes a Jewish marriage, a real Jewish marriage. They had many grandchildren. They lived together for many, many years. But the marriage started as a way to save Devorah's life and to put her name onto his visa. And there were many other reasons why people would get a fictitious marriage, including in the DP camps, as a way to get out of a crowded dormitory, or maybe to get a little extra cash boost that you would get. So there were prizes to get married. And sometimes people would get married to get whatever the prize was without actually being married. And these, as I said, there were quite a few fictitious marriages that became real marriages. Visas and documents and other kinds of, even something like your own room was a big boost in a crowded DP camp. More questions from the chat or?
Rabbi Kalman, you're muted.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the clothes?
I apologize for that. Hold on. I'm sorry for that. Somebody was asking Naomi for your mother's maiden name. I assume they went, you know, based on the picture. I don't know, maybe if they knew your mother.
My mother's maiden name was Abraham. So my mother's name was Sarah Abraham. And okay. Her father was the Aguda representative for Transylvania, 150 around little communities around Transylvania. So my mother came from what could be called Aguda royalty. I mean, and so did my father, but in my father's case, it was more of a self-made kind of thing. He himself was the first Agudas in his family, working for the Aguda in Poland.
Okay, I guess something that was every Orthodox educational effort for girls Beis Yaakov. I guess what other educational were there besides Beis Yaakov?
That's a really good question. There were other Orthodox schools, including there were some attempts to found. Sharim was in Hebrew. That's interesting. I'll talk about Hebrew in a minute. So there were a few others, much less successful. Whether there were and the range would be something like a Mizrahi school. Those are the Yavne schools. So were there Yavne schools? There were also, there may have been Hasidic schools. There may have been Beis Rivka's, Lubavitch was starting. I don't know very much about it, but those are the possibilities. In the Beis Yaakov school, and it's interesting that you're talking about Hebrew because one of the differences between the Beis Yaakov and the DP camps and the Beis Yaakov before the war is that the Beis Yaakov before the war sometimes had instruction in German because a lot of the teachers came from Germany. That letter from Rivka Horowitz asks, where are the German Jews, right? They always came to our help. Rosenheim, first of all, they have the money, they have the professionalism, we need them now. So after the war, there was a basic understanding that no Beis Yaakov would have any German instruction. As a matter of fact, German was a kind of language that was no longer welcome in the Orthodox world or in the survivor community. And you have a much greater problem of girls coming from all over Eastern Europe, and including from Hungary, where many Hungarian, I'm sorry, this, my dog is like crying. Did somebody touch the Ezra? She like wants, I don't know what she wants. Basically what you have is mixed populations and not everybody speaks Yiddish. And there was a kind of concerted effort, and there were many people who wanted to go to the land of Israel. It was a concerted effort to speak Hebrew and to teach Hebrew. And in the DP camp that was in an island, Lingoli, I think it was called, the one that was off the coast of Stockholm, that was the only Beis Yaakov that was held entirely in Hebrew. But there was a real push to teach Hebrew. My mother didn't know any Yiddish before. My mother's native language was Hungarian, which was common for Jews in Transylvania, even very Orthodox Jews. And in the you know, in the camps is where she learned Yiddish, but in other camps, but she also made a real effort to teach Hebrew. So Hebrew language instruction was a big part of the curriculum. I see some other hands up. Do you want to call on people? Jay, you're muted.
I'm sorry. I just like to mute myself in between in case there's noises. You know, that's a good lesson for everybody. It's always good to mute.
You also have a crying dog there?
No, I don't have. I don't have dogs here. But what can I tell you? Okay, we'll start. Okay, Shelley, then Reshi, Rochelle, then Yocheved. We'll go like that.
Okay. I was very sad by that letter that you wrote from Rivka Horowitz because it seems like Jews blaming other Jews. I mean, you're in these DP camps. I mean, I can understand if you're, from what I understood from the Illinois Holocaust Museum, that most people in the DP camps were not Jewish, because people are going from all over Germany, relocating, they're being kicked out, stuff like that. So I can understand why you might not want to be with somebody that's not Jewish, but it seems that she's also very much trashing, I hate to use that word, disrespecting other Jews who may have been more secular, who went through experiences, the same experience that she did because they were Jewish, but because they weren't religious, you know, keep me away from these guys.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's funny how, I mean, I think some of you know that I'm not Orthodox myself. But I do suddenly get defensive. It's funny how I identify so much with this community just as a scholar and having been in it. And one thing I would say, I mean, not to be too defensive, let me try to be a little bit. But one thing I would say is that you might be speaking from the present situation in which Orthodoxy is a real political force. And this is the moment in which that's beginning. And it's a political force that I agree has real animus, hostility to secularism, to secular Zionists, et cetera. But what you're talking about here is an embattled minority basically struggling for survival and feeling themselves about to be swallowed by the great wave of secularism, including, in other words, what they see around them is not just the secular Zionists. There were always secular Zionists. What they see is secular Zionists and all their former Orthodox friends and colleagues and classmates going along with that world. I'm reminded of the kind of the rage in Palestine or later in the state of Israel of, you know, over actually, you know, in 1943, over the fact that that Orthodox Jews like the Tehran children that were making their way from Poland through Tehran to Palestine would then be put into camps. And they're, you know, as the Orthodox Jews always complain, first thing that happens is the payas get cut off and they're put into they're basically expected to become secular. So Orthodox Jews felt that they had survived the Holocaust and were now struggling for the survival of Orthodoxy to maintain the religious life that they had had before the war. And they saw Zionists as not just different from them, but actively taking their children, actively taking their, you know, making it harder for them to refill their ranks. I just remember something else I forgot to say about these Beis Yaakov girls. Among the craziest things these girls did, and remember some of them were partisans, is that they would find out that there were Jewish children in some monastery. They'd hear some rumor and they'd go into monasteries in the dead of night and kidnap Jewish children from monasteries. We're talking about a kind of wild west of Jewish life at this moment. And it's more wild for the Orthodox Jews because they meet one Orthodox chaplain, whereas the secular Jewish world or the modern Jewish world or whatever, I mean, this is a rabbi, maybe he's a reform rabbi, they're so much better organized, they have so much better, so much more, so many more resources. So I'm just saying that, not to say that you're wrong to to feel offended at this kind of dismissal of other Jews, which I'm sure we all recognize as part of Orthodox culture, but to have some, just to have some insight into what it is these Orthodox Jews were feeling and the struggle that they felt themselves to be in, to not only to lead a life, to carry on a life, but to carry on a life that might have some semblance of continuity with the life that had been destroyed. Does that make sense, Shelley?
Yes, I'm saying that as somebody who is Orthodox, but my parents were born in America, small town Wisconsin. Okay, and also there does seem to be, it's understandable, but there does seem to be something about how American Jews, even the religious ones, weren't religious enough for these people. And then, you know, after God forbid, when they need to come to America or Palestine, okay, we'll go there, but you guys aren't good enough for us. We're setting up our own society, and they're almost reinventing the rules, how religious their society was. Everybody sat and learned. They didn't sat and learn. They had, you know, they had to work. Everybody covered their hair. No, not all religious women did cover their hair in the early 20th century, right, even if they were right. Shomer Shabbat. So that's that kind of thing is rewriting history, I guess, gets to me. So, but thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I mean, it's also true that Holocaust survivors were treated, even those with great family trees, were treated as damaged goods within when they did make it to Palestine and North America. They often were unable to find a shidduch. Like there's an example of, I forget which great rabbi's daughter who shows up in Palestine and, you know, makes her way to the local Rosh Yeshiva and says, I'm so-and-so's daughter. Give me your best yeshiva bacher. And he says, I have, you know, in this weird Orthodox market, I'll marry you off to a disabled man. In other words, you are now damaged goods. And she was so offended, she remained single for the rest of her life. So the prejudice went in both directions.
That's true. And when you're talking about Israel, the secular Zionists took religion away from all the Sephardim, for people who came in from Iraq and Egypt and all the rest of them, and sometimes even kidnapping some of the Yemeni kids and stuff like that. So
yeah, now you're getting
very unfortunate.
That's a little far afield. I just want to give other people a chance to ask.
Let's get some more questions.
Let's try to keep them relatively short. It is late, so.
I'll try to keep my answers short. I don't have to answer everything. Okay. Sometimes people just want to make a comment.
Okay, Reshi and Yocheved. And okay, quickly, Vakusha.
Unmute yourself, please, Rochelle, Reshi.
You answered the question because I had a friend who was in one of the camps and they learned Hebrew. They had people come in from Palestine and she actually learned Hebrew in the camps. I don't know which camp she was in. She had been in Siberia, a lot of places, but and they were from they were from people, but they went to a Hebrew school. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I actually have lots of photos of the Zionist shlichim, young women that were sent from Palestine to the DP camps. Big part of what they were doing was teaching people Hebrew so that they could hit the ground running when they came to Palestine. There was a kind of you know, she asked for certificates. She means certificates to Palestine. They were very hard to get. This was a time in which immigration was limited. But the hope was that you would get a certificate.
Well, my friends came to them. They didn't go to Palestine. They came to them.
Most of them didn't.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe this is a little bit of a broader question. I think you mentioned this at the end of your book. You were contrasting the Beis Yaakov after the war to the way it developed in America in terms of the whole culture and the teaching. Like I think you mentioned, you said it was more like a Baal Tshuva element to it, that sort of, I'm just curious if there's something you could elaborate on.
Yes, absolutely. So I think, thank you. By the way, you're the one who bought my book. No,
yeah, like three years ago.
So the difference between Beis Yaakov after the war, which really starts in the DP camps, but really in the 50s with Beis Yaakov of Bnei Barak and the Chasam Sofer. And basically what you have is a movement that's the difference between a Baal Tshuva movement and a movement that's trying to keep what it has secure. So it was always a tension in Beis Yaakov between, let's say, its missionary impulses, trying to appeal to young people who to appeal on in a kind of landscape in which there were competing ideologies. Everybody was appealing, right? So everything was up for grabs. Who you were going to be when you grew up was not at all clear. And in other words, were you going to be religious because you grew up religious? Not clear. I mean, there's still people who go off the derech, but it really was a kind of open question, a huge generation gap. The Zionists would go into Hasidic shtiebels to try to recruit. So everybody was recruiting, and in this atmosphere, Beis Yaakov was also trying to recruit. So it was like an extreme Baal Tshuva movement, not the kind of Baal Tshuva movement that was in North America in the 60s and the 70s, where you're looking for people who grew up in assimilated homes to try to bring them back, quote unquote, bring them back to Orthodoxy. This was a Baal Tshuva movement for people who grew up Orthodox. In other words, growing up Orthodox did not guarantee that you would want to be in. So in other words, to be in, to really to say, I really want to be part of your Benos group, or I want to, I'm signing up with the Aguda. That was the environment in which, that was the environment in interwar Europe. And it was also the environment in the DP camps. They were actively trying to recruit people. And a movement that's trying to recruit people has to be more flexible. In other words, you can't say, come to my lovely Shabbos dinner and I'm going to measure how long your skirt is or how long your sleeves are, which, as we know, is perfectly acceptable practice in Beis Yaakov today. So Beis Yaakov today is now a different kind of environment because it's trying to keep people in as opposed to attract people from the outside. So the way in which you make your message appealing or not, the means by which you try to grow your ranks or try to stop, what's the word I'm looking for, to stop people from leaving, those are different kinds of things. Beis Yaakov now, if there are Beis Yaakovs where if your family has a TV, you can get kicked out of Beis Yaakov. It's not exactly a forgiving atmosphere. That's in Lakewood. But let's say somebody opens up a Beis Yaakov in Wisconsin, they're not going to have that rule there to begin with. They're looking to build a movement. So these are the kinds of differences in how it is that Beis Yaakov went from being bending over backwards to appeal, being totally forgiving of your level of orthodoxy, how it went from that to almost the opposite in 10 years is a very complicated story involving the Chazon Ish and centered around Bnei Barak. And we're going to leave that story for now, but it's an interesting story.
Thank you very much. One other
quick question.
Bakasha.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned that your father wrote a history of the Beis Yaakov. That was in Polish, right? It's not in available.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
I'm just wondering what aspect of Beis Yaakov was it before the war? Was it during the war? Because I know he was in Warsaw during the war and Rabbi Orleon was still running. So I'm just wondering if is it ever going to be translated or is there anything you can share?
Oh, thank you so much for asking. It was in 1936. It was published. It's called The Renaissance of the Jewish Woman. And it's a kind of odd, I think it was, I'm not 100% sure, but if I'm right, after Serge Nehru died, the Beis Yaakov Press announced that it was commissioning a biography of Serge Nehru. And there were two books that came out. One was a kind of children's book in Yiddish called Yamamas Tzava'a, The Mother's Will, which is a kind of almost Hasidic book about Sarah Schneer, by the publisher of the Beis Yaakov Press. And then there was my father's book in Polish, which is more of a broad history of Beis Yaakov. So exactly which one was meant, whether they commissioned it from my father or from Gershon Friedenson or both, I don't know. It's an interesting historical document, in part because it's has a real feminist flavor, which is the kind of thing that sort of disappeared from Beis Yaakov after the war. This feminist rhetoric, it was no longer so kosher. But it also seems to be almost like a brochure. It has like about 30 letters of approbation from rabbis, but also from secular Jews and also from non-Jews. So it seems to be I'm not even entirely sure how to think about it as a genre. But in terms of, and there's definitely important historical information that I got out of it. But I don't know very much about it because I wasn't interested in Beis Yaakov while my father was alive, a real lost opportunity.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for that, Naomi. We look forward to learning from you in the future. Next week, Gabriella Lixko, if I'm pronouncing that right, I hope.
Should I give a little plug for Gabriella?
I was going to, but since you know her better than I, you should give the plug.
So Gabriella is a very interesting person. She's getting her PhD, I think, at Ben Gurion University. She's from Hungary, but she's been living in Israel. Anyway, she is knows more about the Hasidic world. She's more of a Hasidism historian than anyone else. I mean, she basically has just made it her life's project. She's also a tour guide. She travels all around the world to study Hasidism, has talked to many, many contemporary Hasidism, has done tons of oral history. And every other week, she has something called Polish Tisch, which is a kind of online talk about Hasidism party featuring a different Hasidic group every time. Oh, there she is. Oh, Gabriella.
Hello, everyone.
I didn't realize you were here. What are you saying?
Of course I am. Of course I am. Thank you so much for your fascinating
lecture. Did I misrepresent you?
Okay. All right.
I hope I didn't misrepresent you. Say something to the group.
Thank you so much for the amazing words that you told. I'm very, very happy and honored to be here, and I'm already preparing for next Monday's class, and we will take a look at the maps of Beis Yaakov, and we will together try to analyze the various Orthodox Jewish communities which actually gave birth to the Beis Yaakov schools in that particular locations.
And I will be there because I need to hear you.
I'm actually going to be on a plane next Monday during the class, so I won't be here. But
so much. That your mother, it was just so amazing also that you said that your mother organized the Beis Yaakov school in the open ghetto of the city of Torda in Transylvania. And actually, it's not in the map because it was a ghetto school. But I would love to talk about these schools in the ghettos as well. For example, there were Beis Yaakov schools in the Warsaw ghetto as well. And also, as we learned today, in Torda, in Transylvania. And it will be really fascinating where we can see like a huge percentage of Beis Yaakov schools. And in other places of Eastern Europe, where there is a real considerable amount of number of Orthodox Jews, sometimes you can barely see schools. Or the schools were really in the grassroots and in the middle of to be founded, like in Hungary.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We could talk about that, but Gabriella, you and I should probably have a conversation offline about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Then we'll look forward to next week. Like I say, I won't be able to be here. Please God, I'll be traveling. Our son is getting married in a couple of weeks in Denver, so we're off to Denver.
Wow,
Rabbi Kelman, nice seeing all you beautiful people.
Thank you. The next class for Torah Motions on Wednesday. You know, Marty Lechner missed last week. He's back this week at 11. Dr. Sokolow is back on Thursday morning. The Parshia this week, Thursday night. The Siddur Shiur, all our regular Shiurim. So we look forward to seeing you. Of course, acute comment when you talked on television sets, living in Toronto. When the Beis Yaakov, the main Beis Yaakov in Toronto, and people probably know better than I, when they banned, televisions 20 years ago, whenever it was that they, you know, you couldn't get into the school if you had I'll say two things. So a second Beis Yaakov opened up in Toronto, and they got nicknamed the Beis Yaakov for parents who have television sets. You know, if you wanted and you didn't want to go to Opana, which is sort of where my daughter went, like the modern Orthodox Bnei Akiva, you know, religious Zionist school. They didn't want to go to Opana. That's too modern. They wanted Beis Yaakov, but they also wanted a television set. So that was really a second Beis Yaakov opened up. I also know very fascinating, really for another time, and that's why this is after the Shiur when everybody left, whatever. There were Rabbanim in the city who paskined halacha lemaisa that you could lie. And you could buy, you could, like, if they asked you on the application, do you have a TV? And you did, you could lie to get in because, you know, it was more important to get in, even if you lie, you know. And then I will tell you, my roommate, this is from in New York, went to buy a TV. And the owner of the store, it must have been in Boer Park. He asked him, is it okay if I put the TV in an air conditioning box? So he said, yeah, but why? He said, because all these people, oh, no, he wants to buy an air conditioner. They couldn't put it in a TV box. He said, because the people buy a television want it to come out in an air conditioning box. So, that's the world we live in. Okay, enough. Everybody can ignore that stuff. But it is interesting how the transition and how television, and now television, that's not television, the internet. This is, the internet is now the number one. But Baruch Hashem, we use the internet for Torah. Everything in this world Hashem created is neutral, and everything just depends on how we use it. Every character trait, everything. So technology is wonderful and terrible. Depends on how you use it. So we try to use it for wonderful things. Okay, enough of that. All right, everybody, have a wonderful day. We look forward to seeing you soon and to learn. Invite a friend, and thank you very much. Okay, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.